بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها الرسل كلوا من الطيبات وأعملوا صالحا. Good works and halal rosy are intertwined, interconnected. Imagine all the Anbiya alayhim salam are assembled in one gathering and Allah is addressing them. All of them, without exception. Ya ayyuha rusul. Two commands, eat halal and do right works. As a creation of Allah Ta'ala, as a creation that is moving, then you will have needs. You will not be able to move without fulfilling the needs. You will have to have fuel to move. Anything that moves requires a fuel. Anything that grows, moves, produces, it needs some fuel. You won't find anything that grows, moves, and produces not requiring any fuel. It requires fuel. So Allah Ta'ala knows, He made us, He knows this. So the fuel He speaks about is tayyibat, must be right, must be clean. So in every respect, see that that fuel is right. What happens generally, we look at abundance. We don't look at the quality. We look at the quantity. Madrasa, I got so many students, right? Wealth, I got so much wealth. Following and popularity, I got so much. So this is the human weakness, our weakness. And Allah Pak's nazar is not on the quantity, not on the numbers, not on how big, right? And He says it in the pages of the Quran, كَمْ مِنْ فِيَةٍ قَلِيلَةٍ غَلَبَتْ فِيَةً كَثِيرًا. That small groups, they overwhelm big groups. But the whole precondition is وَاللَّهُ مَعَ الصَّابِرِينَ. Sabr is that you be content and you restrain yourself. Whatever you are, you restrain yourself. Just to what Allah Ta'ala has blessed you with. Though it may be hard, it may be a bit difficult, but just hold yourself. Your nafs will crave. You see something, then you will crave. See someone is going for a holiday, everything, crave for it. You desire. Someone is running around for Umrah, you desire. Someone has got a 4x4, you desire. Got a farm, right? Vehicles, you begin to desire, right? So all the things of the world will tempt you. You cannot say that it will not tempt you. But what are you supposed to do? If you want to be with Allah Ta'ala, then Allah Ta'ala says, I'm with you. And bring the sifat. See, my promises are with sifat. You get the sifat, then I am with you. But you don't bring the sifat, you bring it like how you want it, then I don't guarantee you acceptance. I guarantee you acceptance if you have got the sifat. Habsun nafsi ala ma takraw, that's sabr. There'll be a lot of things that you will desire, but you have to hold yourself. Your eyes want to see something, your hands want to do something, your tongue wants to say something, right? Your heart wants to wander around, right? And Allah dressing, Allah, you leave all that. Just tie everything, restrain it, stop it, and just stop it like how I ask you to stop it. Just Stop it. Hold it. For my sake, you stop it. So, in the halal and haram also, you want to stop yourself. Many things you're going to be desiring. See, in this Rosa, this is what you learn. Right? That you have to stop yourself. As much as you're tempted with that food, well, stop yourself, hold yourself. It's tempting. It's delicious. You are tempted to eat it. You know, hold yourself. So everything is going to be tempting. If you, in this Rosa, if you gave in to your temptation, your Rosa is gone. Okay. So this Rosa is giving you a lesson about sabr. If you give in to your temptation, gone. Sometime it's gone, complete, finished. You have to make a qaza for it. And sometimes the reward and the merit of that Rosa is gone. رُبَّ صَائِمٍ لَيْسَ لَهُ مِنْ سِيَامِهِ إِلَّا الْجُوءٍ وَرُبَّ قَائِمٍ لَيْسَ لَهُ مِنْ قِيَامِهِ إِلَّا السَّهَرَ. Right? Sometimes it is totally cancelled. And sometimes the merit and the reward of it is gone. Class. You take a bottle of milk and squeeze a lemon. It's gone now. You know, just one lemon, one tablespoon, and it's gone, finished. It's no more milk now. It's curd. Now it won't fetch you that price. It's gone. The value of it is gone. So such a small change, and the whole composition of it is gone, lost. So you want a good deed, and you want it to be accepted. So the acceptance requires that you must hold yourself. Right. In sadaqah as well, hold yourself. You can't give much, or you can't give anything. Then too, the Quran Sharif says, قَوْلٌ مَعْرُوفٌ وَمُغْفِرَةٌ خَيْرٌ مِّن صَدَقَةٌ يَتْبَعُهَا أَذَى. The sadaqah, charity you want to do, right, you want to be generous, but you're showing the generosity, but you're following it up with bad words. Unpleasantness, you're hurting someone. Right? In the process, you're doing good work and you're following it up with some foul words, impolite behavior, aggression. Right? So Allah Pak says, just kind words, qawlun ma'roof wa maghfiratun, and forgiving, overlooking faults, hiding people's problems, that's even better. Outwardly it seems, you know, I'm doing some works of generosity and I'm doing so much, right? But the better thing is being polite. So that politeness is, it carries so much weight. If you can't do much, but you're being polite. One is, I have it, I'm not doing it, that's wrong. But one is, I don't have it and I'm doing within my means, but overall I'm trying to be polite. Whichever way I can show kindness, I show kindness. Right. They say that one person saw in his dream that Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is saying that so and so is my companion in Jannat. So obviously, if you are told that he is the companion of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, you become very anxious. So he became very anxious, this person here, and then he is the companion of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam in Jannat. That's the ultimate that you can desire for, right? So he inquired about the particulars, the name of the person, etc., and he followed the particulars. Came to the person and spoke to him. And then he disclosed the reason for his coming. So the man first tried to avoid, but when he insisted, and he said, no, I was told by Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. Now it was difficult for him to avoid, because Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam is not a person, any Muslim, any person who has an iota of Iman, can't ignore. Forget him, even his words you can't ignore. Small words, big words. Every word of his, every act of his can't be ignored. Sometimes I look at the hadith kitabs, you know, and every aspect of Nabi's life, they open up a chapter and they'll find a hadith. What he did, how he entered the toilet, for example, how he came out. He'll take pains. He'll prove that hadith would, sometimes five hadiths, three hadiths, and each hadith got about 10 narrators in the chain. So he'll go through all the pain to explain all the narrators, and then show which hadith is most authentic, which is less authentic. Then the wording of the hadith may be just two words. But you understand the love these reporters of hadith had with the Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and his words. So nothing of his can be ignored. Can't ignore it. Everything is very important. So the relationship this Muhaddiseen had with the Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, everything of his they preserved. So when I look at it, I would say that the level of love must be of a different level, you know. It's beyond us to imagine what was the level of the love of this Muhaddiseen. One is the Muhaddiseen, and then you get the Fuqaha. Then they love us even higher than the Muhaddiseen. Because the Muhaddiseen, his work ends in reporting the information correctly. That's his work, isn't it? The narrators he must report correctly, and the information that he's received he must report correctly. Now, the Muhaddis works ends up at that point where he shows you the whole chain. It is a flaw in the chain, he tells you, and the wording of the hadith. And if there's any doubt in the wording, he will show that, he'll point that out to you as well. That here there's a doubt in this word, there's a doubt in that word. So he will report it to you most honestly. So the Muhaddis works ends up at that point. Then the faqih, his work is even above. The faqih will have to distinguish the authentic from the unauthentic, reliable from the unreliable, then sound narrators from the sound, from the narrators that are unsound. You know, check out everything, right? Who's sound, who's not sound, who's reliable, who's not reliable, right? And they have got a standard to work out the soundness and authenticity. It's not any person who can say that he's sound. They've got a standard. What do you mean that he's sound? So in declaring him sound, you have to see several things, all right, which age he lived in, which century, and which town did he live in, who were his contemporaries, and who were his teachers, who were his students, right? What did they have to say about him? How reliable and how trustworthy was he? How sound was he in his deen? What was the condition of his memory? And the memory of his, it was consistent right throughout his life, or there were fluctuations? Did it carry on, the consistency of his memory, did it carry on like that? That is why it is not the work of an ordinary person to just quote a hadith, because he is not in a position to work out all the reporters. If it is just told him that this hadith is weak, now that information is insufficient. What is meant by weak? The word weak, da'if, is a technical term. And the term has got implications. If you didn't learn the technical terms, then it's not right. To give a ruling on hadith is not right, because you didn't learn the technical terms. Number two, what is the rule pertaining to da'if hadith? So you haven't learned that as well. You just saw that this was declared weak. But then you said, no, it's weak, it's unreliable. So that amount of information is incorrect. Right? sometimes you get a da'if hadith or a gharib hadith in Bukhari Sharif, whereas it is practice right throughout the world. It is practice. All the four masabs, everybody practices it. Though it is something that is da'if or something that is gharib, but the whole world practices it. Like, for example, you say, La wasiyata li warithin. Comes in Bihab Bukhari as well. La wasiyata li warithin. So, there's consensus on its being da'if. But there's consensus on everybody practicing it. Everybody practices it. La wasiyata li warithin. What it means? You can't make a bequest in favor of an heir. A bequest in favor of an heir is invalid. Right? So, all ulama, everybody practices it. But yet, the statement itself is not authentic. But it's practiced. Why it's practiced? But the question is why it's practiced. That's why I say it's not the right thing for a person who didn't study the whole science to just extract from the hadith directly. It's unfair to the science. Yes, you studied it properly, right through, you studied the whole thing, ma'alahu, ma'alay, the context, the requirements, the information that connects to the sign. Studied the whole thing properly, right? And if there's any other hadith in that subject, you've studied it, you checked all the narrators, everything you checked, then you come to a conclusion and you say you fail. Otherwise, you're not being just. You're taking a shot in the dark, you're speculating. It's wrong. In a worldly science also, you're supposed to be specializing before you give a decision. You haven't specialized, and you give a decision, obviously you're not being fair. And if it is something related to daily life, then you could be sued in court. You're a doctor, and you haven't made a research, and you're just passing a verdict on a certain thing of medicine, then they could sue you. So it's not fair. There you will understand that it's not fair. But strangely, in Deen, every person just checks up a translation. He doesn't know whether it was translated correctly. He doesn't know the translator himself. He doesn't know all the facts that are connected to the hadith. But he just picks it up. He says, no, this is da'if, leave it out. So I ask you, is that fair to that field? Not fair. So the hadith is saying, La warisa, la wasiyata li warisin. That a bequest made in favor of a heir is not valid. And everybody practices it. Now, why they practice it? They practice it simply because there is overwhelming evidence that the meaning of the hadith is correct. Right. In other words, the information that this hadith is giving on, that's correct. There's other ways through which you can work out that the meaning is correct, although the wording is weak. Right. So now there's so many things connected to the hadith itself. So that's why I say, if you either say, I know it, or I don't know it. And don't you ask things that are above your understanding. Yes, if you are an expert, then you have got all the right. You're specialized, you're expert, you've seen everything. Now you've got all the right to question. But you haven't got the expertise, you haven't specialized, and you're asking. So now the answer is, in a quandary, that how do you answer this person here when he doesn't have an acquaintance with the science? You're asking something for medicine, right? Something that is very deep, something that is very complicated about medicine. And the specialist doctor knows that you are a man of the street. You're not acquainted with the science. So how must he answer you? It's difficult for him to answer you. He will tell you, if you want to know all these things, specialize, learn this thing here. Take out the time, learn the whole science, and then you'll come to a similar conclusion that I've come to. But now you don't want to go, circumvent the whole thing, bypass the whole thing, and ask the specialist directly, then how must he answer you? just to understand your levels. So this thing here has been created by the enemies of Islam, you see. What the enemies of Islam did is, like W.W. Hunter, he writes for the English, right? He writes for them. So he writes that any person that studies under our tutorship, our schools, universities, colleges, then he comes out, he must come out with doubts about his own religion, be it a Muslim, be it a Buddhist, be it a Hindu, be it a Christian, whoever it be. But if he's gone through our curriculum, then he will definitely have doubts about his own religion. It's a matter of khud nahi karte aur kisi ko karne nahi dete. They don't do it themselves. And the one that is doing, then they will create doubts in him as well. So this is how they work. Because they don't want you to be holding firmly to your religion. So how do they get you not to hold firmly in your religion? Create doubts in you. Inject doubts in you. And then how do they inject doubts in you? For an intellectual person, intellectually ask. All right, daif, say. But it's not your forte. You're not at that level. When you're not at the level, then it is not right for you to ask like that. Ask at your level, it's easy for the person to ask. What you qualified for, you ask at that level, it's easy for that person to ask, to answer. Right. Say I'm an ordinary person, I haven't much knowledge, what else I do? Now, the questioner may have a reservation. How reliable is the person? And first, before you're referring to someone, then find out, is he reliable? How reliable is he? How sound is he? Like how you would do it in any worldly science, before you refer to an advocate, an attorney, before you refer to a doctor or a specialist, you can find out how authentic, how reliable the person is. After you made the necessary inquiries, then you refer to him. So the same on Deen also, you find out how authentic, how reliable. That's your limit. So you ask at your limit, at your level you ask. So it's a pleasure asking, is a pleasure answering. But now the enemies had to find a way to create doubts, and for the doubts, the doubts will create weakness in you. So you were a strong Muslim, now suddenly you just collapsed. You drop your guards. That whole column of strength has broken down in you. See, Shaitan found a way how to break you. See, so this is how they found a way to break you, to make you ask these type of questions. Otherwise, you look at it, for a moment look at it, for approximately 1300 years, they were following the Imams, and they were coming out, they were traveling this journey quite comfortably. What you needed to do, just follow one of the Imams. Imams that are known, right? So you follow their jurisprudence, and you will come out safely. Right? So this Imams of jurisprudence and fiqh, their level is far level than the level of a muhaddis. Because a person who is narrating hadith, his duty is only to see the authenticity of the chain and of the word. And then report it, transmit it with that authenticity. That's his work finished. His work ended there. But the faqih's work is double. First he has to authenticate the hadith. Then he has to see what is the common illat. Right. For example, now you speak about ghina, right? Or let's look at a simple example first, then we'll come to ghina. The hadith speaks about switching off a candle, a light, right? Before you sleep, then if there is something burning, right? Some fire that is burning, then extinguish it. It's a sahih hadith. That if there's something burning, then switch it off before you sleep. It's a sahih hadith, right? So the muhaddis will just report the hadith that whatever is burning, then switch it off. So he has done his duty. He reported the hadith with authenticity in a reliable manner. He has given you exactly what has come from Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam that anything that is burning, then switch it off before you sleep. And the reason they give is فَإِنَّ الْفُوَيْسِ قَطَى. Because you get, sometime you get the small animals, rats, etc., then they can cause damage. They will pull the thing, the burning twig, and then they will set the house alight, right? So you see that you extinguish these type of burning things before you sleep. Right? But now, if it is that fire is enclosed in a lamp, you can't expect a rat or something to break a rodent, to overturn it, or like you've got a burning globe, right? It's a light also. Should you put that off as well before you sleep? So the illat is not found. Here that illat was that the rodent will set the house alight. And here it's not possible for the rodent, if a light is switched on, then it's not possible for the rodent to cause any damage after that. Right? So now, there's the hukam, there's the rule also apply here as well. The muhaddis will say, no, it's across the board, you must switch it off. And the faqih will say, no, no. Here, we don't find the common reason. The reason for the prohibition is not found here. The reason for the prohibition is found in other situations, but here the reason for the prohibition is not found. When the reason for the prohibition is not found, so the law doesn't apply here. See that? So the faqih's work is somewhat greater than the muhaddis's work. Muhaddis's work ends up at this point. And his work goes even further than that. Now, if you look for example like this, you'll find a lot of examples. For example, the hadith prohibits bells, right? Bells. Jars. Right? Now, there can be different situations. One is you got a bell for musical reasons. Obviously, the prohibition will apply, right? One is at the time of war you got a bell. Then two, the prohibition will apply because you're alarming the enemy. You got a bell, right, on the animal, on a horse or something, right? That thing is galloping or it's moving. So you're alarming the enemy. Right? So the prohibition will apply. So one is if you got it for musical reasons, one is if the enemy is going to be alarmed, then also it is going to be prohibited, right? A third situation is a person has got a bell just to show off, you know, just to show his position, just that people may recognize him. You know, got a big bell running, like, you know, in an eastern country, he's got a big bell running out his palace or outside his mansion. So to show off his position, people may recognize him, understand and identify with the person. So then you say, oh, it's prohibited, right? But someone has got a bell for some other reason. Right? Like you get, in India you get, till now in some of the remote places, you'll get this hand-driven mills, right? When it's a hand-driven mill, then it's fastened with a donkey or with an animal, and the animal moves. As the animal moves, then the mill also moves, because the mill is tied with the animal. So as it's moving, so the mill is also working. Right? So now, the person that owns the mill, how must he work out that the animal is working? He will fasten a bell around his neck, and as long as it's moving, the bell will be ringing. So now he's got the bell fastened for a valid reason. What's the reason? That I need to see that this animal is moving around. If I don't have this fastened, that thing will stop. Now it's ringing, so I know now it's working. And it's not ringing, then I know I need to shout the animal, and the animal will go again, right? So he's got it for a genuine permissible reason. Right? There's the joke that comes in between here. Is the student came and seen this animal, and the animal got a bell around its neck, and it's turning the mill, see. So he asked the miller, what's the reason for this? To see that the animal is working. As long as it's moving, then the bell will be ringing. If it's not moving, the bell won't be ringing. So the student asked the miller, all right, say for example, the animal just remains stationary and it shakes its head. How are you going to know that's moving? So the miller shout to the student, you better move away because my animal gets spoiled listening to all your bayan. The animal gets spoiled just now. You better move away from here. So what I'm getting at is that the faqih's work, the person that is a jurist, right, his work is higher than a muhaddis. The muhaddis will say, no, it's prohibited across the board. And the jurist will say, no, the reason for the prohibition was something else. Was either that it's a musical instrument. Number two, either it's because of pride, right? Arrogance, or you're alarming the enemy. When all these things don't exist, you're doing for some permissible reason, then this bell will be permissible. An equivalent for bell is how you have a siren today, right? So otherwise, sirens, everything would have been impermissible. So you say it's permissible because it's to warn, to alarm, notify. So you see the work of the jurist is higher than the work of the muhaddis. But to come to that level, it takes a lot of time. You don't just shoot up straight away, fly by night. You just came up, straight you come up, you don't come up with it. You look at all the arguments, counter-arguments, and then eventually you come up, right? Come to this point. So, what we are talking about, the duty of a faqih. What is said? Yeah. He saw, this person saw Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, right? So, he got the particulars and he followed it. He followed the particulars. So now, the one that saw the dream, he tried to avoid the whole thing. But when Nabi Sallam's name was used, now he couldn't ignore this. It's Nabi Sallam now. And he's not an ordinary person. Right? See, you rank people differently. An alim, a hafiz, a qari, a muhaddis, a faqih, a mufti, right? And unfortunately, you get that enemy of Islam who created a confusion in all the ranks. Right? He armored the ordinary person to be able to speak at the level of a faqih. He is not a faqih, but he pretends to be a faqih. He's not a muhaddis, but he pretends to be a muhaddis. So he feels that I'm in a position that I can run anybody down. But he's not equipped. So when he's not equipped, then he's pretending. He's doing something that he isn't. He's showing off to be what he isn't. And he doesn't know, he doesn't realize that he's destroying his own self. He doesn't realize it. So when this person heard that this is from Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, he said, all right. Now I can't take this lightly, if you take it seriously. He's asking. So he says, my story goes like this, that I got married, you see. And it was a newlywed. And I see after a day or 2 days, that, or maybe a week or so, and my wife has delivered. Obviously it was not a microwave zamana, where you get things ready in a minute. Huh? Right. This miracle again, see, there's another thing, that I want to share with you. In India, in a certain town, woman was a little bit more pious. So people used to flock to her for her bayans, whatever. But to be able to give bayans, discourse, etc., then you need to have a certain level of maturity. Everybody is not at that level. Now this woman saw that there was a pious woman in that same province that she was living. She connected herself to that pious woman, so-called pious woman. Alright, that pious woman wasn't married. But in spite of her not being married, she gave birth to a child. And then she claimed after that, after giving birth, she claimed that I have delivered like Maryam alayhi salam, without the agency of her father, I have also delivered. Like she did it as a miracle that I am pious, and because of my piety, I delivered without the agency of her husband. She believes, this one, yeah, believe that one. And she just gave me the story. So people broke away, obviously. So Allah Ta'ala allowed this to happen once. In this whole universe, Allah Pak allowed it to happen once. And it won't be repeated. He allowed it at a time that wahi was also coming from the heavens. So if there was something against the norm, then there was a wahi to support it. Right? That the wahi will support it and it will eliminate any doubts. Now, when wahi has been terminated, you know, if some woman say that I'm also pious and I delivered without the agency of a man, Jibreel Islam came to me and this would happen. Right? So will you believe that? No. Because she's got no way to prove herself. Until wahi was coming down, so there was a way to prove this. And now that wahi has been not suspended, but terminated, finished. One is to say suspended, and one is to say terminated. It's totally terminated. Now if a woman comes around and says that this has happened to me, what had happened to Maryam alayhi salam, then this has been terminated, complete, finished. When it's terminated, now how is she going to prove herself? Number one. The second wrong would be, then 100 other women will get up and say, oh, we also went through the same experience. How are you going to regulate this? So Allah Ta'ala, stop this, put this to a total stop. Nobody can talk about this. Otherwise, from every nook and cranny, every granny also will claim, no, I am also at the level of Maryam. I am also at the level of Maryam al-Islam, like she had delivered without the agency of a man, and I have also delivered. Can you regulate this? Can you control this? Nobody can control it. Allah put a stop. At that time, the wahi was coming. There was a prediction that it's going to happen. In advance of the birth, there was a prediction this was going to happen. It happened, and the wahi supported it. And there was a miracle at the birth. Child in the cradle, a day-old child, and he's talking fluently, clearly. So now, so much of circumstantial evidence is what? Now, if someone does it, does he have any circumstantial evidence? Nothing. So Allah terminated that. Complete stop. Total stop. So, this is why our ulama discourage women giving talks and orating, because they are sometimes deficient. Emotionally, it's unanimous. They agree that they are deficient, right? When they're deficient, then if they're going to be orating, etc., then they could mislead people. Like this woman, she's pious. But she heard about that woman there, and she got influenced. She remained connected to that woman, whereas that woman went completely off the track. And she is speaking about it. Understand? Now, can you imagine now how much problem she will create? How much of confusion she will create? No, don't do this thing. A man, he can venture out. If he says something, he could be tested, he could be tried. Now, a woman is supposed to be concealed, right? Now, how is she going to be tried out? It's going to be difficult to try out. A man, you can try him out. Check him out, try him out, investigate, scrutinize the person. You've got all the ammunition to scrutinize him. But a woman, then you're not so free to do all these things. That is why the muhaddisin have agreed, right, that if any jinn has to report a hadith, then we will not regard it as a reliable hadith. Why? Jinn literally translates as something that is hidden, right? Because we don't have the equipment to scrutinize and verify the authenticity. Like in any court of law, if you come up, you make a claim, right? And you say, all right, the court asks you, where's your proof? And you've got three jinnas to prove it. Will they accept it? Are they going to accept it? So in any court of law, they're not going to accept it because they can't scrutinize, they can't verify, they can't put them on trial, they can't check them out. So because they can't be verified, they can't be scrutinized, they can't be checked out, so the jinn is called jinn because it's hidden. And woman is also hidden. Aura. Don't say aura. Something that is concealed. When it's concealed, that you can't investigate, you can't scrutinize, you can't check her out properly. So leave her. From the public forum, leave her out. What she's meant for, leave her at that place. She's meant for the home, leave her at that spot. There'll be exceptions, obviously. Aisha, she's the Ummul Mu'mineen. But then there's so many hadiths to prove her credentials. Rasulullah is proving her credentials. That's different now. Everybody says, I'm Aisha. Like another woman claims that I'm Maryam, right? Then you say, no, this reasoning is lopsided, wrong reasoning, right? So you see how easy deen is. Ma ja'ala alaykum fi deen. Deen is easy. But just that we went in complicated issues. When we went in complicated issues, now it seems difficult. But whereas it is easy, like I say, for 1300 years, we followed the Imams, and there was no complication, no confusion, moving straight. Suddenly, we're going to do things our own way. Some Western person engineered the style here, too corrupt and confused. We latched onto it, and then confused ourselves, not realizing that was an enemy's strategy to weaken your whole system. He did this to smash you down. Not that he was wishing well for Islam or for the Muslim. He did this to smash you down. And then you held on to that. And then you lost out. See? That is why one of the founders of this movement, of the Salafi movement, India, one of Muhammad Hussein, or Siddiq Hussein, he says, people get into this. Why? Because they feel that this is a little bit more relaxed. Right? They hop away from the Imams to this because they feel that this, we can do our own thing, we can reason our own selves. They find a little bit of relaxation. But then eventually he says, this Imam Siddiq Hussain, what he says, eventually that person moves out of Islam, Allah Ta'ala forbid. Why he moves out? He's giving the reason why he moves out. Reason is obvious. Because he moved out so that he can free himself from the shackles. But when he moved out, he still saw he's under some shackles, right? So he said the easiest way to get out of the shackles is to come out complete. I'm out of it completely. Now I'm out of shackles. So, uska akhi anjam baddini ho jati. He comes out of Islam complete, out of it. See how it leads from this point to that point, and then he's out, totally out. So this way is a way of security. I gave an example previously, like a railway track, right? And the railway track is safety for the rail, for the train, and it is also direction and progress. The safety is direction and progress, so long as it remains on the track. Outwardly, you would say, hey, this thing is constrained, is restricted to the track. You know, and who said that they must remain on the track only? Why can't they hop out of the track? Right? Where's the dalil for it? Where's the proof? Is it da'if or is it sahih? Where's the proof for it? Right? Who said it? How reliable is the person? You can make all these arguments. Right? Now, if that driver of the train, he gets influenced with your arguments and he allows it to be thrown out of the track, I ask you, will there be any progress, any movement, any safety? No, it's gone stop. It's stopped complete. So, in this mazhab, there is a safety. there is progress, right? There is security. Though it seems that as though you are constrained, like to the track, one track. You're one track minded, but in that one track mindedness, there is safety, there is progress, and there is a direction, you're moving. And the day you think of moving off, and you're gone. You're in the wilderness, and you are in a jam, you can't move down. So anyway, we're coming back to this incident. So he saw that his wife had delivered. First week of marriage, and she delivered. So now, he's deliberating within his mind. Now, what do I do? I'm caught up in this situation. Many thoughts passed the mind. Oh, this woman, she deceived me in getting married. That's one thought. The other thought that went through his mind is, all right, it's a human being, it's a human error, human weakness, right? And we all have weaknesses. That's the second thought that passed his mind. The third thought said, all right, if it's a human error, then how am I supposed to be reacting, responding? Tomorrow, Allah Ta'ala forbid, it could be me or my child or my family that was involved in something similar like this. Then what would I have liked? Number four, all the thoughts running past his mind. If I'm going to expose this, right, then I'm going to bring embarrassment to her, to her siblings, to her parents, to her household, to her family, to her community, right? And to this child that has been born. Until the child lives now, it will be a disgrace, embarrassment. Oh, you were born, you know, this was the circumstance that you were born in. He is deliberating now. I have all these facts before me. What do I do? Then he sees, all right, there is a word of encouragement from Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. What is the word of encouragement? That if you conceal someone's fault, Allah Ta'ala will conceal you. If you conceal someone's fault, Allah Ta'ala will conceal your fault on the day of Qiyamah. And I don't think any of us that is here or anywhere in the world today can say that he had no faults from the day that he came of age till today. We have got some minor, some major faults, which we will not like them to be exposed. Right? If you ever get exposed, you'll feel very embarrassed. Allah will conceal it, swept under the carpet, leave it there under the carpet. Don't take it out. So he's concealed our mistakes, and he has honored us by concealing our mistakes. He honored us. So the man is reflecting, thinking, right? This is one other option. I've got five options in my mind. There's a last option. I'll conceal this because I need to have some type of a security, some type of a cover for my hereafter. In this world, we have covers, isn't it? Whether motor car cover, insurance, medical cover we have, right? Credit insurance we have, cover. A home cover you have. Now they got even a funeral cover. So it's cover for everything. Even for your death you need to be covered. So cover for everything you need. Cover for everything. So what cover have I got for my hereafter? He's deliberating. He's got all the options before him and he's deliberating now. What cover do I have for the hereafter? This is something I can use at least. I will be kind to her. I will not expose her. I will not mention it to anybody. And I will not bring any disrepute or disgrace to the family. I won't do anything. And then he's working it within his mind now. How must I work a plan that I cover up? It's an Islamic land. The child has just been born. The whole world will get to know about it. How must I plan it? But I must get a cover for my hereafter. Something, I need some security for my hereafter. So he tells the wife now, don't worry, I'll try and work out a plan. I will avoid any type of disgrace, embarrassment to you, to this child, to your family, and to your folks, but I will work out a plan. Don't worry about it. So what he does, this, before the Fajr, Azan or something, before the Fajr, he wraps the child and quietly sneaks into the masjid and leaves the child behind a door, just before the namaz. Just before the namaz, he even left the child behind the door. Right? But the namaz started, and the child, one side the imam is giving the qirat, one side the child is giving his bayan. This side, ye qirat suna raha hai, aur wo apni bayan kar raha hai. Both. So after the namaz, everybody is looking towards the end where they're hearing this crying. So the imam spots the child, and he says, it's an abandoned child. Any volunteers to take care of the child? So the man couldn't say, no, I volunteer to take the child. فَرَدَدْنَاهُ إِلَىٰ أُمِّهِ كَيْ تَقَرَّ عَيْنُهَا وَلَا تَحْزَنُ. So we return her with respect, return the child with respect back to the mother. Right? Without disgrace, without embarrassment, just relying on the encouragement of Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, that you conceal someone's fault, hide someone's fault, and Allah Ta'ala will hide your faults. You cover someone up, and Allah Ta'ala will cover you. Don't we want a cover? For the cover, what don't we do? Just for a reliable cover. Yeah, the cover is being given by Nabi Sallam himself, immaculate person. You can't doubt his integrity, right? Every other insurance and cover can fail, can collapse. The possibility, element of collapse is there. But Nabi Sallam has stood as a guarantee and assurance. He's given you assurance. Can it ever collapse? Can't collapse about this. So he says, because of this, that Allah Ta'ala has blessed me with this. So we're talking about, we started off where Allah Ta'ala speaks to the Anbiya alayhim salam, as though all the Anbiya alayhim salam are all assembled in one gathering. I'malu kulu min at-tayyibat wa amalu saliha. Like I say, anything that is stationary, anything that is moving, mobile, right? Anything that is moving, anything that is growing or moving, then it requires fuel to carry on moving, to carry on growing, right? Producing, reproducing, it requires fuel. Can't, otherwise it can't continue. So Allah Ta'ala knows this because He's made us. So He says, "Kulu min at-tayyibat," the fuel that you must take in must be pure, halal. Though it may be less, but ensure that it is halal. It mustn't be contaminated. Once it's contaminated, then it's gone. Small or big, but there's a contamination now, then I have moved away. I'm no longer with you now. I moved away. But it's called contamination. Why I moved away? I moved away because you didn't trust in me. I said, I will make things work for you. I have taken responsibility of your sustenance and rosy. So you should have relied on me. Then why did you move away? Why did you break my system and went into haram? You broke my system, went to haram because you didn't have the trust in me. Had you had the trust in me, then you wouldn't have crossed over to haram. So I am your creator and you don't trust me. If your wife tells you, I don't trust you, how do you feel? I don't rely on you. I don't trust you. How do you feel? Don't you feel cheated? Don't you feel disappointed? So Allah Pak is complaining as though that you left me and you don't trust me. I am giving you the assurance that I will provide. مَا مِنْ دَابَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ إِلَّا عَلَى اللَّهِ رِزْقُهَا. One person went to perform namaz. So in his mind, he's thinking that this imam, what does he do for a living? What does the imam do for a living? So anyway, the doubt went a little bit strong in him. So after the namaz, he's asking the imam, and what do you do for a living? So I'm sorry, it's the other way around, not the imam. The imam is thinking about this person here. But this person here, what does he do for a living? Right? Not the person, but the imam. The imam has got this doubt that this new person is coming. I don't see him doing a work, but what does he do for a living? So now, after the namaz, the imam went and asked the person, what do you do for a living? So before answering him, the person repeated his namaz. So now the imam is saying, I had one question, now I got two questions. One is now what you do for a living, and number two is then, why did you repeat this namaz of yours? He says, all right. Let me answer why I repeated the namaz. I repeated the namaz because I doubted your integrity. You asking me, what do I do for a living? When Allah Pak has taken responsibility, مَا مِن دَابَّةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ إِلَّا عَلَى اللَّهِ رِزْقُهَا. Allah Ta'ala said, I am responsible. So you don't trust Allah Ta'ala that you're asking me this type of a question. Don't you trust Allah Ta'ala? So when you don't trust Allah Ta'ala, then can you be a mu'min if you don't trust Allah Ta'ala? Can you be a believer? So when you're not a believer, then how can my namaz be correct behind you? How can my namaz be valid behind you when you don't trust Allah Ta'ala himself? So therefore I had to repeat my namaz. So this is the first command that Allah Ta'ala directs towards the Anbiya, the highest of all creation. وَعَمَلُوا صَالِحًا, the second command, and do good works. In the tafsir, the Shaykh Ghulayn Rahmatullah says, that Allah Ta'ala speaks about good works and connects it to halal. Halal and good works. So that means there is a relationship between good works and halal. Right. So if a person is eating well, eating halal, then good will come out of him. Because good went into the system, then good will flow out. But if he's filling himself with haram, then haram will come out. Impermissible things will come out, doubtful things, doubtful activities, doubtful behavior, wrong behavior will come out of him. Because wrong is going in, then wrong will come out. If you planted mealies, mealies will come out. If you planted a thorn tree, then a thorn tree will come out. You don't expect a grape tree to come out when you planted a thorn tree. So you planted haram into the system, then haram will come out. And if you put in halal into the system, then halal will come out, halal will flow out. But so important it is that this assembly of Anbiya alayhi salam, Allah Pak is addressing them all without exception. Kulu min at-tayyibat wa amalu saliha. Eat halal and do righteous works. Acche acche khao aur acche acche kaam karo. Acche khao aur acche kaam karo. Is that difficult? Allah Pak tawfiq nasib karay.